Our presenter today is Joe Thalberger, and the topic will be the injustice of war. Joe Thalberger was raised on a farm near Vibank. He started teaching at age 19 in 1961, and later worked as a consultant in special education for the Saskatoon Public School Board in the late 60s, where he did a lot of individual evaluation and assessment, so lots of IQ testing of kids with learning problems. In the summer of 1974, he took over part of the family farm, converting it to dairy hay production and becoming a house husband in the winter months, looking after their four kids while his wife worked as a teacher. He's still doing a bit of farming today in a small way, right up until the present. With the winters off, he began studying Bolshevism and World War II in earnest, even to the extent of attending 5 or 6 international history conferences in the USA. Joe began attending Unitarian services in 1962 and has been peripherally associated with Unitarians ever since. Joe?
I just want to say a word about how I kind of got into this business, studying war. Three of my grandparents were born in the Soviet Union and just north of the Black Sea. As you know, 10% of the population of Saskatchewan are so-called Germans from Russia. My other grandmother was born in New Jersey. So I had relatives in the Canadian Army, in the American Army, and in the German Army. And as closely related as first cousin once removed. But actually I had no interest in the Second World War, almost none, until I met a cousin who was born in 1915 in Ukraine. And I went to see him about life, what it was like there in the 20s and the 30s. And the stories he told me kind of blew my mind. Then naturally, it was a natural progression to get into the 40s. And he was been drafted into the German Army. And there again, the stories he told me just blew my mind. I couldn't believe the stories that he had told me. So being a house husband, not much to do in the wintertime except babysit. And as you know, the devil finds work for idle hands, so I started studying war. I'll tell you, I consider myself a Marxist from the age of 20 until 33. I met this cousin in 32, and he kind of got the Marxism out of me. Where am I at here? So I grew up, studying the Vietnam War, as many of you did, and I guess I gradually came to the conclusion that especially the Vietnam War was just totally 100% useless. It achieved absolutely nothing, and I gradually came to that conclusion for most of the wars. As far as I'm concerned, Canadian participation in all the wars since 1914 was 100% useless. And it still is today, and I, for the life of me, can't understand how we, even the local Ukrainian community, can be supporting civil war in the Ukraine. And I have contacts there still, and it's a total disaster for those people living in the East. And I guess one of the problems in First World War, there weren't too many civilian casualties, but in every war since then, the civilian casualties have greatly outnumbered the soldier casualties. And, anyway, it's been a bit of a disaster. In most wars, demonizing the enemy seems to be the main objective. And so you start out with little lies, and gradually they kind of be embellished, and they kind of grow with the passage of time. And pretty soon everybody ends up hating the other side, and in all kinds of atrocity propaganda, most of which I think isn't true. You get all kinds of misunderstandings that start out, and I'm sort of reminded of a silly joke about these two guys from Saskatoon who were going down to Mexico, and this is in March. So there's still snow here in the ground. They're kind of overdressed. They get into this little town in Oklahoma and stop for a coffee and a lunch. And the locals all know that they're kind of strangers. So they get talking. Well, I wonder where those guys are from. Well, why don't you go over and ask them? So one of the guys goes over and asks him. He says, mind me asking you where you guys are from? The guy says, Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. Well, he nods and he goes back to his buddies. And they said, well, where are those guys from? I don't know. He says, they don't speak English. So I know that my sister is afraid of flying. So she travels by Greyhound bus. And her son was studying in Southern California. She wanted to go down and visit him. And she's talking to the Greyhound guy in Arizona. And he says, where did you say you were from? Sasquatch land. So, I don't know, people can misunderstand things quite easily. I'm going to get into, maybe I'm going to, of all the wars, the Second World War seems to me the one with the most distortions, deceptions, misrepresentations. And I'd kind of like to start with the history of the Nazi Party. Started in 1920, and their main objective was to save Germany from communism. I got a quotation from Hitler written in February 4th, 1945. With our rear secure, we could have thrown ourselves, heart and soul, into the ambition of my life and the raison d'etre of National Socialism, the destruction of Bolshevism. So there you have it. Nothing could be more clear. The ambition of my life and the raison d'etre of National Socialism, the destruction of Bolshevism. So if you study the history of the party, I forgot to bring a book with me, a most interesting little book. They didn't get along with the communists, and the communists didn't get along with them. So there was a lot of fighting from 1920 until 34, 35, when they sort of abolished the communists completely. But the Nazis never made much of a headway. You got to have a program, a positive program, if you're going to say, we don't like communism, so what are you going to do to replace it? And the main idea, I think the main philosophy in National Socialism was something they called Volksgemeinschaft, which is people's community. Now, to understand what that meant, you have to put it in the context of Marxism. So in Marxism, the main idea is the class struggle, the exploitation and oppression of the working class by the wealthy, the rich against the poor, the employer against the employee. Capitalism can't be reformed. It usually requires some form of violent revolution. Well, the Nazis came along and said, this is nuts. There are no class enemies in Germany. Yes, there's a poor class, but we can achieve much more by working together cooperatively for our mutual benefit. We need the upper class. We need their managerial and technological expertise as much as we need the workers. And so they abolished trade unions and so on. The party represents the working class. And they pretty much told the capitalists what to do. And if you don't comply, we'll take you guys over. And for the most part, they mostly complied. So everybody working together for the common benefit. That was the big idea. They didn't make much of a headway. I think in the 24 election, they got a little over 6% of the vote. The 28 election, I think they fell under 3%. Communists, by the way, were getting 10, as high as 17% of the vote. Until the Depression came. In the 1930 election, they jumped to 18%, and in the first 32 election, they jumped to 37%. In the last election in 34, they got 44%. But there's no doubt in my mind they would have never come to power if it weren't for the Depression. Where am I at here? I'm going to compare National Socialism with Stalinism from 33 to 39. That's when the Nazis were in power. I would say that Hitler killed about less than 200 people, and most of them were in the Rome Purge in 34. Most of them were Nazis, and he claimed there was going to be a civil war, and he eliminated 150 of those guys. They were Nazis, but they opposed Hitler's program. They wanted a revolutionary kind of thing. Meanwhile, Stalin, I think, murdered countless millions in that time. And I think that was one of the things to be said for them. Most people I wasn't aware of was that in the fall of 37, the NKVD came out with a policy whereby the male head of every German household was to be taken out and shot. My cousin, who's still alive down here, lives in an old folks' home here. He lost his dad and three of his older brothers. Now, there were 2 million Germans living in the Soviet Union at that time. And I don't know how widespread it is. I know that in our area, which is just north of the Black Sea, he says there was only two old guys left in the village. And the women still refer to it as the year they took the men. Now, one of the interesting things about this was that there were lots of Germans who joined the Communist Party. And they became head of the kolkhozes, what's a kolkhoz? Co-op farms and so on. They were all taken. There was no discrimination. The communists got picked up along with those who opposed communism. Anyway, they all end up getting shot. They weren't told that at the time, of course. They were told they were all sent to Siberia or somewhere. And they only found out many years later, after the Soviet Union collapsed, the records were all opened up, and a lot of the records were there. Oh, and maybe I should talk a little louder. Because I can, yeah. So the war started. Hitler kind of was very upset about the Treaty of Versailles, and I think quite justifiably. So he managed to kick the French out of the Ruhr. He took over Sudetenland, which was 90% German, which had been given to Czechoslovakia. And he wanted those parts from Poland that had been former German territories that were inhabited by a majority of Germans. Danzig was 90% German. But the English and the French told the Poles, we will support you, don't give back an inch of territory. So he made a deal with Stalin, and of course they took over on September 1st. They invaded Poland and took over the western half, and two or three weeks later the Russians invaded and took over their eastern half. Now Stalin kind of outfoxed Hitler on that one. He didn't join it. He let the Germans sort of basically defeat the Polish army, and by that time the West had declared war on Germany, and they barely even noticed that the Russians had moved in and taken over their half of Poland. In the course of the next year, Russia took over Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, Bessarabia, Bukovina, and 10% of Finland. And again, we sort of turned a blind eye to all of that because we were so absorbed with defeating Hitler. I think Hitler definitely miscalculated. The last thing the Germans wanted was war with the West. And he didn't think that they would actually go as far as declaring war on them. And in fact, my understanding is he offered to pull back out of Poland. But once the war had started, it was unconditional surrender. There was no negotiating. You even have a case of Rudolf Hess was the number two man in the Reich. And in May of 1941, he spoke quite good English. He was also a pilot. He flew over to England, and he knew some guys over there, and he wanted to talk peace, thought he could persuade them to talk peace. Well, what happened to Rudolf Hess? They threw him in jail. He was held basically incommunicado, given life imprisonment at the Nuremberg trials, and according to his son, was murdered by the British Secret Service when the Soviet Union collapsed in 89. We have no idea what Hess thought about the war because he was basically held incommunicado and all of his writings were destroyed. So that seems to be one of the things. I mean, all the top Nazis were all killed off at the end of the war, so we have really no idea what they thought about anything. Unfortunately, the Second World War turned out to be the first war in which there were these enormous civilian casualties. I have a friend, I don't know if she's still alive, but she was a nurse in Darmstadt, December 6, 1944. She worked in a hospital as a nurse. A big Red Cross was painted on the roof. Nonetheless, it was bombed, and parts of the hospital started burning. So they moved the patients out into the courtyard. Along came the, I don't know whether British or American pilots, and machine gunned the patients while they were on the ground. As you know, it was the general carpet bombing of German cities, there were about 60 cities and 60 in Japan, that were where the civilians were directly targeted. Idea was it was hard to knock out. The industries were all located on the outskirts, much like IPSCO or whatever, you know, it's on the outskirts of the city, but the people that worked in them worked in the city. So easiest thing to get rid of the armaments industry was to kill the people that worked there, which was, so they invented the firestorm and so on and so forth. I have a friend who's still alive, lives down near the Golden Mile. This is his story. We surrendered, about 25 of us surrendered on April the 17th, 1945. 8 of us wore Waffen-SS uniforms. They were taken out and shot right before our eyes. The rest of us, he said, they took off our outer clothing, our coats, they took all our food rations, our sleeping bags, our tents, put them in a pile, and along came a tank and ground everything into the mud. We were put on a truck and turned out into an open field, into the weather, without our clothing, our coats and so on. We had nothing to eat, basically, or to drink for the first week. He estimates that about one-third of all the prisoners died from either hypothermia or disease, or whatever. And there's a Canadian actually wrote a book called Other Losses, in which he describes in detail what have come to be known as Eisenhower's death camps. Now, I should say, a lot of my other cousin was taken prisoner by General Mark Clark in northern Italy. Here's his story. We couldn't have been treated better. In fact, if we had known how well we would be treated, he says, we were surrendered a whole year earlier. We got everything, he says, cigarettes. He says, life as a prisoner under General Mark Clark was much, much better than life as a German soldier. And in fact, when I started talking to him about some of these things, he refused to believe that what happened to a lot of these Germans under Eisenhower, you know, but I guess you've been treated so well. So it's the same old story, I think, in all wars. You get the good guys and the bad guys on all sides. Just wanted to say another item here. Mein Kampf. The only authorized edition of Mein Kampf was published by Hearst and Blackett in March of 1939, about 5 or 6 months before the war started. In 1943, the Americans came out with their own translation of Mein Kampf. It's known as the Mannheim edition. I have both. And when you compare them, you hardly think you're reading the same book. You can tell the reason they brought this out in 1943 was to discredit Hitler and make Hitler look like a jackass. And that's the only copy that's been distributed for the last 70 years is what's known as the Mannheim edition. And if you read it, you basically come to the conclusion of how could the Germans ever fall in prey to such a jackass like Hitler? And when you read the other one, and it is very interesting and very well written. What else? Starvation in the camps. You all see these emaciated corpses and whatnot in the concentration camps. What you're never told, though, is that most of that occurred in the last 4 months of the war, that Germany lost its air force basically in December of 44. The Allies had complete run of the skies. They bombed and strafed everything that moved. And all the trucks and trains trying to take food to the camps were basically bombed. They had to move everything at night. So was all that intentional? There's no way that was intentional. Just everything kind of collapsed at the end of the war. I knew a woman who her infant twin sisters, died of starvation already in the fall of 44. They were in the Sudetenland. She told me that her sisters weren't the only ones in the graveyard. The graveyard had a lot of other infants. They couldn't get milk. Food was so poor, mothers didn't have breast milk, and the kids just died. That was already in the fall of 44 going on among the Germans. So the people in the farms always had food, but the people in the cities didn't fare very well. Time's up. So I'll take a couple of questions if you are...
Does anyone have questions or comments? Yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't get your version, I read the first version of Mein Kampf, but what did you say the second version was, and where do you...
Well, the original version was translated by James Murphy and published in March of 39. The other one is known as the Mannheim translation, and that's the one that has been distributed ever since. The other edition is very hard to come by. I got a copy quite accidentally, yes.
Prime version was to keep Germany from becoming communist.
Yes.
Initially, but then we here in the West, we always hear that he was trying to produce a super race and get rid of all undesirables. How does that hit you?
That is just almost totally a propaganda fiction. Most of the Nazis were from the South. They all had... black hair, well, mine's white now, but dark hair. The light-haired people were in the north. Now, there were a few Germans who had this super race theory, But they were a very small minority. So what you find in a lot of this propaganda stuff is there's a grain of truth in everything. And it just gets magnified and blown all out of proportion. I don't think there was any... You know, you heard about the Untermenschen. And, you know, the lower peoples. And there were certainly many Nazis who thought that way, but the majority, I don't think, did. I mean, yeah, you got to go back to 1930, in the 30s, and the British thought they were pretty superior, and just about everybody thought they were superior. That was the way everybody thought in the 30s, you know what I mean? Our ethnic group was more important than any other, and that just was a natural, normal thing. That certainly existed in Germany, but was it any worse there than anywhere else in the world? I don't think so.
Okay. As you've been speaking, I've been thinking about the present day and how the alliances are apparently forming and peace is threatened once again. Do you have a comment on today's political situation?
Well, yeah. I don't know. It seems to me that... Oh, by the way, I did print up a bunch of stuff. They're at the back. You can help them set yourselves to a copy, which I summarized much of what I talked about. They're laying at the back there. But I think that... the name of the game in recent years was to demonize the Arabs. And basically, Israel has tried to sort of, they had a lot of enemies over there, and nothing could be better for them than to get the Arabs killing each other. So I think that's sort of the basis of what's been going on. Now you got all this anti-Putin stuff, and of course Putin supported Syria. He was not enthusiastic about, you know, killing Saddam Hussein and all the rest of that. So they've kind of gone after him now. I just met a guy from Kirkuk here a couple of months ago. It's in northern Iraq. Here was his comment about the situation there. He says, yes, Saddam Hussein killed a lot of people. And he was in the army at that time. And he said, but he says, the conditions now under the American occupation are 10 times, no, he says 100 times worse than they were under Saddam Hussein. Now everybody's killing everybody. You don't know who your enemies are. You know who your friends are. He still has a brother and his mother in Kirkuk. He says, my mother has to go out and do the shopping because my brother's afraid to go out. Somebody's going to shoot him. I don't know. I think it's a terrible disaster there. I don't know. Now you got the ISIS business, and of course, it's just perennial and eternal war with the Arabs seems, and the Muslims seems to be the main objective of many of the people in the West. And anyway.
Yes. Joe, thank you for your comments this morning. Just one thing about the German sense of superiority that we've been told about. If we were to take a look at the English sense of superiority as well, that was carried over into the colonialism, that might be another example of how people have raged. But I was interested in your comments about demonizing the enemy, and I don't know if you want to reflect on this or not, in the sense of war as a means of creating a contrary, an enemy. But I see this also in religion, and in race, and in politics. And we can use the example of our current federal government and their attempts to demonize the opposing parties is another example of this act. Mm-hmm. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, I don't, that seems to be part of human nature. I don't know what you can do about it other than to... Yeah, I just... I used to think Harper was kind of not a bad guy. You know, I wasn't. that enthusiastic about him, but I didn't think he was that bad. But I just don't understand his warmongering in Libya, in Iraq, now in the Ukraine. I mean, I just have no understanding of it. I don't know how what gets into their heads to think that the civil war is the worst of all possible wars, I think, usually. And what do you do about it? I don't have any answers. That seems to be part of human nature, other than to, I guess, talk about it. Talk to people from the other side. When I listen to people, I turn on the TV and I hear somebody castigated and pilloried in the media, I want to hear, I think the opponent should be given double time. And if I don't get the double time, whoever is making the accusation in my mind is probably wrong. And the guys they're criticizing are probably right. And until I hear their point of view, I tend to take the other side. But anyway.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Joe. It's quite an interesting topic, and I'm sure we can go on for a while yet. But perhaps during coffee we can have further comments and discussion or questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.